This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will hear from Jeffrey Frank. He is the author of Ike and Dick, a book about the odd combination of personalities and the politicians who became president, Dwight David Eisenhower and Richard Milhouse Nixon. Also on the show, we are slated to hear from the fantastic Mary Wilson, part of the Supremes with 12 number one hits. She is in Baton Rouge for a production Saturday night at the LSU Union Theater, in which she will salute the great Lena Horne. Also, John Biganay, who is a remarkable writer, in his production Rising Water is showing this week and next at LSU. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org works as well if you're trying to reach us online with a inquiry about our guests. And we lead with Jeffrey Frank. He was the senior editor at The New Yorker, the deputy editor of the Washington Post Outlook section, and he's the author of four novels. His latest work is a great account of the relationship between two United States presidents, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Joe Klein says Jeffrey Frank is an elegant writer with a novelist's eye. The relationship between Eisenhower and Nixon, in all its complexity and weirdness, is a treasure chest that he unpacks brilliantly. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi, nice to meet you. Nice to talk to you.
Great to talk with you. And it started in 1952. Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower, they got together on the Republican ticket. How did it happen?
Well, I mean, it's a very good question, because Eisenhower didn't really know Nixon. They had met once before at a retreat at the Bohemian Grove, this exclusive men's club north of San Francisco. But they met briefly in Paris when Eisenhower was NATO. But Eisenhower barely remembered him. And Eisenhower didn't even choose Nixon. When Eisenhower was nominated in 1952, he had no idea that it was up to the presidential candidate to choose his vice president. He said, oh, do I get to do that? Kind of. And yes, you get to do that. And his advisors, particularly Tom Dewey, who was the governor of New York, and others around him were urging Eisenhower to choose Nixon. Nixon was on a list of six or seven people, and he had several things going for him, one of them being that he was a Californian, that he was a red hunter in a time when Senator McCarthy was sort of becoming bigger and bigger, that he was young, though he was only 39 years old. Eisenhower was 62, but seemed a lot older than 62. And furthermore, Nixon was an internationalist. He was voted against the conservative wing of the Republican Party. Then he supported the Marshall Plan, the aid to Europe after the war. So all those things sort of helped Eisenhower go along with it. But it really wasn't Eisenhower. I picked Nixon. It was General. You wanted to choose Dick Nixon, and he said sure.
Well, it's hard to believe for those of us who grew up with Richard Nixon, and I was not alive in 1952, but Richard Nixon was 39 years old, one of the youngest people to ever be on a national ticket. He was, in fact, 4 years younger than President Kennedy was when he was elected president in 1960, defeating Nixon, who still was young at 47. But Nixon was a guy who did not grow up as a son of privilege. He was from a big state, but what other assets did he have?
Well, let's say he was also a very smart guy, and he was kind of a star in the Republican Party then. I'm not going to compare him to Marco Rubio today, but he had that one quality that's similar. People wanted him to come speak at their meetings, at their fundraisers. He was a big star because he was also the man when he was a congressman. He had helped to catch Alger Hiss when he was on the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And that was a committee that was not held in high repute even then, and certainly not now. But Nixon was perhaps the only member who tried to sort of follow the rules of law and jurisprudence.
And by that time, in 1952, independent of his presidential quest, Dwight Eisenhower was one of the best-known Americans and one of the most heralded for his work in World War II as the Supreme Allied Commander. He was a hero of a stature that we've rarely seen in this country, hooked up with an unknown who gets involved in a scandal right at the start. Why didn't he dump? Why didn't he dump Nixon when the Checkers scandal?
Well, a couple of things. One, by the way, you mentioned his stature. I can't think of anything quite like it. He was so popular. He was so beloved that both political parties wanted him to run on their tickets. The Democrats were pleading with him to be the Democratic candidate. Jimmy Roosevelt, FDR's son, Franklin Roosevelt's son, wanted him to be the Democratic candidate. And one senator, Paul Douglas of Illinois, suggested, well, you could run on both tickets, and then we'll have different vice presidential candidates. So he was of enormous stature. And Nixon at this time he was not only a first-term senator after running a pretty mean race in California, but he'd only been in the Senate for 2 years. But Nixon had one quality that Eisenhower didn't have. Nixon had been a lieutenant in the Navy during the war. Eisenhower, of course, was one of very few five-star generals. But Nixon could, in combat, political combat, Nixon knew how to play the game better than Eisenhower did, and he won. And Eisenhower had tried to remove him from the ticket. He wanted him off the ticket during the scandal, but one of Eisenhower's weaknesses or strengths was that he could never do things directly. He always tried to have a hidden hand, someone else do his dirty work for him, and nobody could quite pull the trigger for Eisenhower, and Nixon survived.
And Nixon at one point told the great Dwight David Eisenhower, one of the great Americans of the 20th century, basically he used a profanity, told him to you-know-what or get off the pot, didn't he?
Yeah, that's not only did he say that, but in his first memoir, Six Crises, he had it come out, you better fish or cut bait. But yeah, he used the profanity to him, and he was very upset. He thought his entire political career ending in an instant, going down the drain. In fact, before he gave this famous speech, this Checker speech, he got a call from Tom Dewey saying, "Dick, I hate to tell you this, but General Eisenhower's advisors think that when you finish your speech tonight, you should resign the ticket." Nixon was just speechless. He had no idea. He had completely terrified. As I say, saw his whole life going before him. And then Dewey went on and said, "And furthermore, Dick, you could make yourself a hero by resigning your seat in the Senate, and then you could run in a special election and come back bigger than ever." And Nixon said, "Well, there are various accounts of what he said to Dewey then, but it all adds up with you better believe you're going to wait and see what I do."
Uh-huh. Jeffrey Frank is the author of Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage, Richard Nixon and Dwight David Eisenhower. 1952, they come together. They end up serving as president and vice president for 8 years. Then Nixon runs for president in 1960. He is the favorite, but he loses a cliffhanger, and some blame Eisenhower for the loss.
Yeah, I mean, there were many reasons for the loss, but Eisenhower certainly wasn't helpful. Perhaps the most damaging thing said about Nixon in that whole campaign, and it's a remark that everyone remembers, was Eisenhower at a late summer press conference, and this was a weird press conference. Everything had jumped around. People were even asking him about the Potsdam conference from 1945. But a man from Time magazine said, "Mr. President, can you think of one major contribution or one major idea that you adopted because of Richard Nixon?" And Eisenhower said, "If you give me a week, I might think of one." Everyone laughed, end of press conference, and that remark just haunted Nixon and haunted the campaign. Jack Kennedy used it in his campaign in ads. I mean, Eisenhower was shown giving the whole reply, and that was a Kennedy ad on TV.
And Kennedy and Nixon were bitter political enemies in 1960, but prior to that, they were actually friends when they were U.S. senators and congressmen, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they were politicians. So to use the word friends, I use it very loosely, but they were very friendly indeed. When Nixon won, as I mentioned, this very, very mean-spirited race in California against Helen Hagen Douglas, Kennedy went and spoke to some students at Harvard and said, "I'm really glad that Mrs. Douglas lost. I would have hated to have worked with her." When Kennedy and Jacqueline Bouvier were married, the Nixons were invited to the wedding. Kennedy asked Nixon to support his membership in the Burning Tree Country Club. When the Senate was reorganized, when Kennedy was very ill with back surgery, Nixon protected his place in the reorganization of the Senate. And Mrs. Kennedy wrote to Nixon saying, "Jack thinks you're one of the most wonderful people he knows. He's so grateful to you." They said they were very, very friendly with each other. Their offices were right across the hall, and everything changed in 1960. There's nothing like a really spirited competition to turn friends into enemies.
Was Eisenhower proud of Nixon when Richard Nixon came back from the political graveyard and won the presidency in 1968?
Well, he certainly was. He certainly wanted him to win. And by the way, he certainly wanted him to win in 1962. He didn't. He wasn't very enthusiastic in his behalf, but he had complete contempt for Kennedy. He thought he thought he was just a whippersnapper. Though he wouldn't have probably used that word. Yeah, he didn't. He never had much faith that Nixon could win. He knew that Nixon was not someone who people took to personally, but he was impressed by his tenacity and by his determination to come back. And there was another factor, as you know, in this too, and that was the fact that these two people who had barely known each other when they first got together were now an extended American family.
That's true, and we've had David Eisenhower on the show, the grandson of Dwight David Eisenhower. And he ends up marrying Richard Nixon's oldest daughter, Julie. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, Julie and David had known each other very little when they were children in Washington. And there's a wonderful picture. I have it in the book of them sort of looking at each other in 1956 when they were 8 years old. David was going to Amherst in 1966. Julie was going to Smith. And they were 7 miles apart, and someone suggested they get together, and they fell madly in love. They really, really hit it off, and they've been inseparable ever since. They're still married, happily married after 45 years, I guess, and that just happened. They started dating in 1966. They announced their engagement to their family in 1967 to the opposition of General Eisenhower, who liked Julie just fine, but didn't want to see David getting married at age 20, which in fact he did. They got married at age 20, 1 month after Richard Nixon was elected president.
Well, Nixon and Eisenhower, they won presidential elections 4 times between 1952 and 1972. And to put that in perspective, in the, 41 years since then, Republicans have only won 5 presidential elections, 2 by Reagan, 1 by the elder Bush, and 2 by the younger Bush. And Nixon and Eisenhower were much different kinds of Republicans than we see today. Would they be at home in the GOP as we know it in contemporary terms?
Eisenhower probably was not at home in the GOP even then. Eisenhower was truly a rhino, a Republican in name only, though there were some parts of the party that he felt close to. And anybody would have loved to have had him as a candidate at any time because he was a sure winner. Nixon would not have been happy in the Republican Party today. He was saying privately he really was uncomfortable with the right wing of the party. He told one aide, and I have it in the book, he said, "Is anything worse than a left liberal is a right wing conservative?" And he was a real centrist, a real pragmatist, and that was a trait that he always had. And there's a certain awareness of what was possible that he never lost sight of.
It is curious, Jeffrey, that the Eisenhower Nixon legacy, if you combine the two, and it's hard not to, it starts with a scandal in Checkers and it ends in a scandal in Watergate. Richard Nixon is at the apex of the action both times.
Yeah, I mean, I have a chapter at the end, sort of trying to deal with how on earth could a man who is so talented in so many ways and so smart in so many ways and in some ways so visionary, the opening to China, the arms treaty with the Soviet Union, some of his very interesting domestic policies, how could he have let this go to pot so seriously? And I have some interesting answers, including some of the people I talked to. I talked to Julie and David, but I also talked to a man named John Hughes, General Hughes, who was Nixon's military aide starting in the 50s, and people like that. And you begin to get a picture of it. Part of it was this almost revolutionary time in the United States with the Vietnam War and the protests in the streets. But it is a little bit baffling because Nixon would have been a sure thing in 1972, and even so, I mean, as you know, he won enough 49 states, but he let this happen. And I sort of believe that if Eisenhower had lived, and Nixon always respected Eisenhower, always wanted his approval, if Eisenhower had lived, I don't think it would have happened.
All right, hold on. We'll talk more with Jeffrey Frank about the most interesting combination of personalities, two politicians, Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, who became president. Ike and Dick is the book. Back after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Jeffrey Frank. His book has been praised in many quarters for its detail in The Odd Couple of Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. It started in 1952, and of course, Dwight Eisenhower died when Richard Nixon became president, and Richard Nixon ended up resigning in disgrace on August 9th, 1974. May seem like a whimsical question, but I think it's legitimate. Lou asks, Jeffrey, who was the better president?
Eisenhower did the most important thing a president can do, which was to keep his was to sort of handle the issues of war and peace. There's been no one sort of like him in the post-war years. He got us out of Korea because he was Eisenhower. He was the five-star general. He could just say, well, this war is unsustainable. We're out of here.
He's now regarded by many as one of the top 5 or 10 presidents of all time.
Yeah.
Is that legitimate?
I think so, sure. I mean, I always have trouble rating presidents, but certainly we all on my list, I would always put Lincoln and Blinken and Washington and probably both Roosevelts, but I would put Eisenhower definitely in the top tier for sure.
Well, getting back to your original statement about Eisenhower actually wanting Nixon off the ticket in 52, and Nixon, through the force of his personality, stayed on. Here's a guy who led the Allies to victory over Hitler in World War II, and he couldn't handle Richard Nixon.
He couldn't handle Richard Nixon. One of the things that Richard Nixon understood instinctively was the power of television. When he gave that speech, and it was basically told to leave the ticket, even though Eisenhower did not tell him directly. If Eisenhower had told him, "Dick, I want you off the ticket," then he was gone. But Eisenhower couldn't do that. Couldn't pull the trigger personally. So Nixon, speaking to 1/3 of the country at that time, 60 million people, said, "Write to the Republican National Committee when I'm finished. Tell them what you think." And they overwhelmingly said, "Well, what a great, you know, that's great. We love you." And Eisenhower had no choice.
Well, Nixon was a guy who was relentless. He never stopped, and he stayed on the ticket. And he and Franklin Roosevelt are the only ones to win 4 national elections. Nixon was vice presidential candidate twice, but he has a legacy that it cannot be ignored.
It's true, but he also was also, I think, deeply scarred by losing a couple of elections. The loss to Kennedy in 1960 was really, really traumatic for him. He thinks he should have won. He always thought the election was stolen from him. And then losing the governorship in 1962 when he ran for governor of California, that was just humiliating. I don't think he really cared about the job. He had no interest in sort of the water supply problems in Southern California. Those issues were too small for him. But it was humiliating. And his chief rival at the time was Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York, then the biggest state in the Union. And Nixon thought the least he should have been able to do was to be governor of the second biggest state in the Union. And he lost very badly. And he thought that was the end of his career.
Well, we thank you, Jeffrey Frank. It's a fantastic book, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much, Jim. Good to talk to you.
My pleasure. 297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. And we're joined now by the remarkable and legendary Mary Wilson of the Supremes. And, of course, she's been a solo star for over 40 years now. Good morning to you, Mary.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great, and belated happy birthday to you.
Well, you know, you're okay because I actually celebrate the entire month.
Well, March and Mary, they go together, and come Saturday night, you'll be at LSU, and you'll be saluting one of the great performers of any time, Lena Horne.
Yes, I'm so thrilled with this show. You know, we've been doing it for about 2 years now, and it's just a wonderful opportunity for me to portray such a wonderful lady, Miss Horne.
Well, Lena Horne was a star who spanned decade after decade after decade. She lived to be almost 100 years old, I think, and she lasted a long time. Mary, you've stood the test of time. I'm sure you related to her as an idol when you were growing up.
Yes, of course. You know, in our home, our parents were like really they loved Lena Horne and people during that time. And sort of all of the children kind of just grew up knowing Miss Horne because of our parents and, you know, our moms and our aunts who all tried to dress like her. And obviously in the black community, you know, she was just a huge hero. And what I love about doing this particular tribute to Miss Horne is that you get a chance to see her speak, because it's a multimedia type of a program where I do sing in the show, but the author, James Gavin, really tells a story of how she had a lot of hardships, you know, in her life, being a black woman. But, you know, in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, it was not a good time for artists of her stature. And so she had a lot of difficulties in life, even though on stage you would never know that, because she was always beautiful. She was always smiling. And she was just such a wonderful entertainer. So, grew up just admiring her. And then, of course, when we got older, I had the opportunity to meet her. And that was just, it was like meeting, it was meeting a real legend. So, I'm very honored to be in the show.
877-217-5757, wherever you are in North America or beyond, for the fabulous Mary Wilson, original member of the Supremes. You grew up in the great city of Detroit in a housing project, born in Greenville, Mississippi, though.
That's right. And I think my father was from this area, Louisiana. We're not really sure of that. He probably would be 100 and something years old. So, you know, they didn't have a lot of birth records that stayed around, so we're not sure exactly where he grew up or where he was born, but it was in this area, so I have a kinship to the South.
It's a story that's been told before, but you were in a housing project, and the Supremes actually began in that area. How did you and Diana and Florence get together?
Well, yeah, you're right. We did grow up in the projects, and it was a wonderful time, 1956 or so, when rock and roll was still very, very, you know, new. We kind of got caught up in that the newness of rock and roll, and we met in elementary school, actually. Florence and I were on a talent show, and I think we were like in the eighth grade, something like that. And after the show, she and I became friends because she admired that I had gotten up there, and I was actually pantomiming to one of my favorite groups, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. And so I'm only 13 years old, right? So here I am. I'm up there pantomiming to I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent. And Florence was singing Ave Maria. Oh. Now, here we are, 13 and a half years old, something like that. And afterwards, we kind of just started talking. She says, "Oh my God, you had the kids just all wound up," and I said, "And your voice is so beautiful." And so we became friends. We walked home from school, and we said, "Well, if anyone starts a little group, let's remember each other." So we became friends from that moment on. And about a month later, she ran up to me and she said, "This group of guys called the Primes want to put a group together. Would you like to be in it?" I'm like, "Yes!" And she said, and one of the guys just went over across the street and asked this girl named Diane, would she like to be in it? And there's another girl. And that's kind of how we got together, you know, in the projects. It was just a fun thing to do. But, of course, we got into it and started really doing little record hops. And pretty soon we started recording.
12 number one hits in the 1960s for the Supremes. Mm-hmm. How many appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show?
I think they said something like 16.
16.
And, you know, 16. And we're told that we were on more than that little puppet. What's the name? Topo GGO. Yes, that was so fun, because at first Mr. Sullivan didn't know any one of us, you know. He had no clue which one was which. And pretty soon, after a couple of shows, he started coming over to us and really talking to us and getting to know us, and he started making jokes, because he wasn't a really entertaining kind of man, you know. But with us, he just started really being very, very friendly, and pretty soon he would say things like, "And here they are, the girls!"
Didn't he introduce you once as the three colored girls from Detroit?
No, he didn't say that. But what did he say? he said something that was really quite hilarious, and everybody around the country was talking about it. He says, "And that Donna Ross, I'm gonna get her," because we were late, and you know it was a live show, like your show is live, and so that was really a stretch. And he says, "No one should be late." So we were changing clothes and doing a commercial, and we came and we were late. And so he says, "That Diana Ross, I'm going to get her because I know it's her, da 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 da." And so that was really funny. Everyone got a kick out of that.
Charles on North Foster. Charles, you're on with Mary Wilson.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning, Wilson. My question would be is, what would you say to a young lady in elementary and middle school who wants to perform? And can you talk about your exhibit, Come See About Me, and when we might see it in Baton Rouge?
Well, you sound like Tavis Smiley. Oh, that's wonderful. Great voice you have, sir. But the exhibit, first of all, is my Supremes gown exhibit, and it has something like 50 of the Supremes original gowns that we wore on the Ed Sullivan Show and all over the world, actually. It is now at the Afro-American Museum in Philadelphia. And it started in January. It will be there through June. It tours around the world, actually. And I'm very proud of it because it really shows, like I said, all those beautiful gowns, but it also has text that has to do with the history of the Supremes and the history of America. So I would say if anyone's near Philadelphia, please go and see it. The other question you were asking,
I think you got it. 297-5633. We've got a few folks who want to talk to Mary Wilson, and we'll try to get to as many of you as we can. Nicholas on Goodwood. Hi, Nicholas. You're on with Mary.
Thank you. Good morning. Of all the performers who have cited you personally as an influence, who would you be most proud of? The two or three right off the top of your head. Thank you.
You mean like groups and singers?
People who say they were influenced by you.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you most proud of?
Oh, gee. Well, you know, obviously you have the career of Beyonce, you know, who's really great. And I think that she has certainly done just a tremendous job. Her parents, her managers, you know, have done just a tremendous job. Because some of the people that I really love would be Mariah Carey. I think she is absolutely wonderful. I'm very proud of her. The other girl, young lady, Mary J. Blige, who is a wonderful career going. In fact, now she's into acting. I saw her the other day on a show, and she was just brilliant. So, I mean, there are lots of young ones out there who are doing just fine, and I'm very proud of them. You know, obviously, our friend Oprah Winfrey is just great. She said that she was influenced by the Supremes. You have Whoopi Goldberg. I mean, we have a lot of people out there doing a lot of great things.
How did the Supremes break up? What caused it?
Well, you know, it wasn't one. It happened slowly. Obviously, first Florence Ballard was put out of the group, actually, due to certain things. Florence had a very horrible thing happen to her. She was abused when she was about, we were the primates, we were still singing. And she was abused, and that kind of really destroyed her soul. So even though we became famous and we were receiving a lot of money, leading kings and queens and doing all those things, she just wasn't able to get over that trauma that had happened to her. So eventually she was put out of the group because of her behavior. So then, of course, Diane left in 1970, January. So pretty soon, it was just me left, and I, you know, had other girls come in the group, and I realized that it was not like the beginning. It was not like the three of us, the original Supremes, and I left the group in 1977. So it was a sad time, but it was also a time for me to emerge, and I'm so happy that I'm able to say now I'm a bona fide star as Mary Wilson.
There you go. Bali in Brookstown, you're on with Mary Wilson. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
First, I'd like to say I'm definitely enjoying the show this morning. And my question, Ms. Wilson, is I'm listening to this little audiobook by George Carlin, and I believe he mentioned you all And I want to know, like, your most memorable situation with George.
George Carlin? Did you have some...
Oh, is that the comedian George Carlin?
Yes, yes.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, George, back in the day, we used to have lots of the famous comedians would open for us. And George Carlin was one of those comedians who we worked with in Las Vegas. I think it was in New York. We were at the Americana Hotel. We worked with him. And he was just a hilarious guy. I don't recall any particular situation, but it was always fun because he was a very real kind of human being. You know, he definitely spoke his mind. And he was always very funny. But that was pretty much all I can remember at this moment.
Dominic in Grand Coteau. Dominic, you're on the air with Mary Wilson.
Good morning. It's an honor to talk to you, Ms. Wilson. My question is, what do you think of, like, American Idol and these singing competition shows? And would you and the Supremes have competed on them?
Well, you know, one time we did have a competition that we were involved in. That was when we first started singing as the Primettes, and it was actually before we went to Motown Records. And it was called the Emancipation Proclamation Festival that was held every year in Canada. And, you know, coming from Detroit, Canada was just across the bridge there. And we actually won that talent show. And then after that, we went to Motown and auditioned and got a contract. But in terms of the American Idol and those type of shows, I have to be very careful what I say, but I'm going to say it. I find that, yes, lots of careers have been established because of it. However, personally, I don't think it's good in terms of personal growth for a lot of the young people because you're falling down on your face in front of millions of people. And sometimes that can scar people, you know. It's just not a – we the Supremes had all of our work. Thank God for Motown. They gave us training. We did a lot of woodshedding, you know. We had a department at Motown called Artist Development, and we were actually taught and trained by professional people how to act and talk and all these kind of things. So when we became famous and had our hit records, we were already professional. However, these people are not professionals, and they fall down on their faces, and some of the things I see is just horrible because it doesn't give them enough time to learn properly, you know. So that's my take on it. Sorry.
Mary Wilson is the guest for a few more minutes. She will be at LSU at the Union Theater, and it's, by the way, the new and improved Union Theater. Quite a venue for Mary Wilson, who will be performing in Stormy Weather, the Lena Horne Project. Biographer James Gavin is the narrator, and it is a full media presentation. If you'd like more information, 578-5128. We'll be back with Mary Wilson after this 90-second pause on WRKF. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we rejoin the conversation with the great Mary Wilson. 12 number ones as a member of the Supremes from 1964 to 1969, and she'll be in Baton Rouge, Saturday night at the LSU Union Theater for Stormy Weather, the Lena Horne Project. 297-5633 if you'd like to join us in our remaining moments with Mary Wilson. Mary, you're a busy person. You performed all over the world. What are some of the things that you have going independent of the presentation Saturday night?
Right. Well, you know, one young man asked about the gown exhibit. That's one of my most recent sort of activity. But I also have a new recording out, which is called, Life's Been Good to Me. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of those, you know, mom-and-pop record stores where we can run down and buy it. Now you have to download it or upload it. I'm not quite sure what it is these days. I have to ask my grandchild which one you do. But it is on, I think, iTunes and Amazon. And it's a beautiful recording, so I'm very happy about that. But I'm also the spokesperson for an NGO company where I speak about the landmine clearances where in different countries they've had civil wars and bombs are still laying around the farmlands and things like that. So I traveled to countries like Vietnam and Sri Lanka, and there are people who now deplode, I think it's called, the bombs, and I'm part of that. So I enjoy doing things other than singing, which is, you know, my career. So those few things are, I think, my most recent, the gowns, the new recording, and, of course, the Lena Horne show, which I want to tell people that I'm not portraying Miss Horne. What I'm doing is just singing some of the songs, about 10 of the songs that she recorded and made famous, and then the author, Mr. Gavin, narrates it. But we also have film clips of Miss Horne speaking on various topics and also singing. So it really is a multimedia type presentation. I'm very proud of that. So, and then, you know, I'm studying acting. I'm presently living in Las Vegas, and I have 8 grandchildren. Had my 69th birthday Wednesday. I'm very happy.
Wow.
Because, you know, we've lost so many of our people from our generation here lately. And so I'm happy to be breathing and standing and talking and singing and still traveling around the world.
Dr. Lauren Scott at LSU, you're on the air with Mary Wilson. Hi, Dr. Scott.
Good morning, Jen. How you doing?
Fine.
My wife and I were in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago. I had a speaking engagement there, and we went to see Human Nature, which is a group of 4 white guys who from Australia who do Motown music. Yeah. I think they're sponsored by Smokey Robinson. And the night we were there, there was somebody from the Supremes in the audience. Number one, I was wondering if that was Ms. Wilson. Number two, I was wondering, what has she seen that show and what she thinks of it?
Yes, I was there. I was there because I, too, am one of the sponsors of that group, Human Nature. I recorded on their album. And, by the way, they're from Australia. And they do a great show. I was over in Australia with them doing some TV and performances there. And they said at that time, they said, our dream is to come to go to Las Vegas and have our own show. And I was like, yeah, right, me too. You know, but they did it. I mean, one of my sayings is dreams do come true. And I tell you, those guys made their dreams come true. They're excellent on stage. They put on a wonderful show. And it shows that if you really dare to dream, you can make those dreams come true.
Michael in Port Allen. Michael, please be brief with Mary Wilson.
Yes, Mary, hi.
Hi.
I want to know, I can't remember, but did you ever play at the Supremes ever sing at Independence Hall in Baton Rouge back in the 60s? And also, I would like to know if you, hello?
Yeah.
I'm here.
Yeah, also, I would like to know if, you know, people, I don't want to know about the feud, but are you and Diana still, are you communicating now? Because I knew there was once a little thing going on there.
All right, what about you and Diana?
Did Jim make you say that?
Yeah, I wanted him to ask it.
Well, the first question, I do believe, I know we played Baton Rouge back in the 60s. I'm not sure of the venue, but I think you could be right, we did. And if you know of that, if you could find that out for me, because, you know, I've written 2 books, and I try to always update my memoirs because I might do another book. I've written 3 books, actually. And so it would be good to know if we actually did play that particular venue. And as far as there was never really a feud, but I know a lot of people saw that the Motown 20th anniversary on TV, and there was definitely something that went on. But you see, you know what? People have disagreement. I mean, and especially in groups when you have such a close relationship and then something happens and you no longer, you know, you're career goes in opposite directions. Sometimes you just, and when you grow up, you just can't seem to get back on that same level of friendship. And that kind of has happened to Diane. Not that we hate each other. In fact, I love her and she loves me, but we're just different now and trying to find our own selves. So, you know, I'm hoping that, yeah, maybe we can get back together in one last tour because people are doing that. And it might be soon. Actually, at 69, it better be soon if we're ever going to do
well,
it.
Well, Diana was here a few weeks ago with the symphony. So
Oh, wonderful.
We got two of the three Supremes in Baton Rouge a few weeks apart. And,
Well, that's great. Uh-huh. Well, you know, we love performing. Diane loves performing. I love performing, and it would just be great if we did, if we were able to get beyond that. But sometimes it's just hard in life to do that. You know.
Well, Mary's the prettiest Supreme.
Oh, she will. Thank you very much. Well, that's not going to get us closer.
Was Tom Jones in love with you?
I was in love with Tom. Yes.
You were in love with him. Was he in love with you?
I think so.
So why didn't you marry?
He was already married. Now, that's a lesson that we need to get out there. We were young, crazy, you know, that kind of stuff. But we're best friends now, and it's, you know, it's wonderful. But, you know, when you're young, you do some crazy things, and you just act on your feelings or your emotions. Hopefully you can grow up, mature, and get wiser and don't do those kind of things. But the truth is I was in love with him, yes.
Well, Mary Wilson has many people who've been in love with her as a performer, and she will be on stage Saturday night, 7:30 at the LSU Union Theater. Mary?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt you. But where are the girls out in Baton Rouge? I've been talking to all these guys. Hey, girls, come on, we're doing together.
I think all the guys wanted to talk to Mary Wilson.
I love it. Thank you so very much.
All right, sweetheart. Well, see you Saturday.
Okay, I hope to see everyone out there. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We're joined in studio now by a gentleman who's also involved in a remarkable production. It's taking place at the Studio Theater at LSU from Swine Palace. It's Rising Water, the trilogy from John Biganay. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Jim.
And John is a man who's been saluted for his work all over the country. You've had productions in many venues.
Of this play and Shotgun, the second play in my trilogy, there have been over 25 productions and stage readings around the country.
Well, tell us about Rising Water.
Rising Water stemmed from a column I wrote for the New York Times just after the levee collapse in New Orleans. I began to wonder about what it was like for the people trapped in their attics, then on the rooftops in that first terrible week. And I decided to tell a story about one of those couples who were awakened in the middle of the night, hours after the hurricane had passed, by the water filling the city. They rush into their attic, and in the first act, they go through their marriage because they're surrounded by the mementos that we keep up in an attic, and in the second act, break onto the roof as the water continues to come.
John Biganay. He's published 7 books, including Oyster, a novel, and The Torturer's Apprentice. And his latest work is Rising Water, and it is at the Swine Palace Studio Theater, and it's ongoing through the 17th of this month, so there is an opportunity to view this fine production, and if you'd like more information, it's 225-578-9277, 578-9277. You're a man who knows New Orleans quite well.
My family's been there since the 18th century.
You've been writer at in residence at Loyola?
At Loyola, yeah. I teach at Loyola now, and I've been poet at residence at a number of other universities.
So New Orleans is a city, as you know, as well as anyone. It's a magical place, unlike any other, certainly unlike any other American city. How much did it take out of the city when Katrina came and called?
It's been devastating. In my neighborhood, for example, we only got our street lights back last summer. For 7 years, we had nothing but darkness every night. The city has 150,000 fewer people than it did the night before the hurricane hit, so it's been absolutely transformative.
And you capture some of the feelings that have permeated that great city since Katrina in this production.
In this play, which happens that first night after the levee collapse, and then in my trilogy I go on in Shotgun, which is opening in Lafayette on Saturday night at Theater A10, 4 months after the flood, and in Mold, the third play, which will open in Southern Rep on March 20th, the summer after the flood.
Well, in Rising Water, a couple awaken in the middle of the night to find a pitch-dark house filling with water. That's something that actually happened to more than a few people.
Across the city, yeah.
And many did not make it.
Well, the water, in my neighborhood, the water came up 8 feet in 10 minutes. And so if you were awakened in the middle of the night by water, not knowing where it's coming from, you had very few minutes to make the right choice, which was get in the attic.
Were you there?
No, I left the morning before. It's the first time I'd ever evacuated for a hurricane.
You said it 8?
8 feet in 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
The water came rushing in. The breaches were growing. In my mother's house got 16 feet of water, for example, because there were so many breaches occurring along some of these canals.
What part of town did you
I live in Lakeview. She lived by the University of New Orleans.
Well, yeah, right by the...
By the lake.
By the lake, so...
Yeah.
That'll do it, and it happened. And many people go to New Orleans and they see the French Quarter in downtown, and with a few exceptions, it looks somewhat similar to the way it looked before Katrina. But when you move out of the city, there are still areas that look like a war has taken place or a natural disaster.
The difference between the part of the city that was hit only by the hurricane and the part that was flooded is dramatic. You can't tell that anything happened where it didn't flood, but in my neighborhood, there are still empty lots everywhere you turn. Streets that are impassable since they're collapsing, one problem after another.
Rising Water became the best-selling show in the 20-year history of the Southern Rep Theater, and it's the winner of the 2006 National New Play Network Commission Award and 2007 recipient of an Access of Artistic Excellence Development Production Grant. You got this going pretty quickly after Katrina. The creative juices must have been flowing pretty well.
Well, at least the anger was flowing pretty well. We produced this just 18 months after the levee collapse.
Mm-hmm.
The theater was in a shopping center that was set on fire after it was looted. We could still smell the smoke in the seats when we opened the show. The audiences didn't leave after productions. They would sit for an hour and just start talking about what they themselves had experienced.
John Biganay, he has published 7 books, and his play, Rising Water, will be shown Saturday night and through the 17th, actually, through St. Patrick's Day at Swine Palace Studio Theater. Now, when you bring this play on the road, as you are, who are some of the actors? Do you bring the people with you who are in New Orleans?
No, each of these productions have been individual, so, although here at Swine Palace,
you've got
Christine McMurdo Wallace is playing. Camille was in the very first production, and this is the second time she's playing the role. And George Judy, I'm sure Baton Rouge audiences know, is playing Sugar, her husband.
And they've both been on this show, and they're both remarkable actors.
Quite extraordinary. Actually, it opened last night and continues through the weekend and then on to the 17th. And I saw the production last night. It is breathtaking. They're brilliant actors. The set is really quite extraordinary. And we had a full house, so it'd be good for people to call for reservations.
We have a listener who says she went with you and some writers to Paris last summer.
Really?
Is that right?
Yes. We were more or less homeless for a year, my wife and I, after the flood. We lived first in a daycare center and then found a little place we could rent until June, but our house still was unlivable. And I got an invitation from Paris, the American Academy, to come and teach, and I've been doing that the last 6 or 7 summers.
That's not a bad place to go for the summer.
Better than being homeless in New Orleans.
So, but you got out of New Orleans the night before the levees broke.
That's right. We drove to Dallas where my brother lived.
How did you find out what had happened?
On Tuesday morning, the hurricane actually went up the Mississippi state line, and so we were on the weak side. But Tuesday morning, we were packing our car to go back to New Orleans. No one had figured out yet that the levees had breached. And we went inside for a cup of coffee. My brother said, there's something on CNN about the city flooding. And he said, maybe you shouldn't leave yet. And we drank coffee and saw that our lives were about to be changed.
You said you were angry when you wrote the play. Are you still angry?
Furious. That was not a natural disaster that hit New Orleans. It was a man-made disaster. Those levees were defective. In 1992, there were warnings that that levee system could collapse, and the Corps of Engineers ignored those warnings. Those people, 1,600 people, died needlessly. So I'm still angry, yes.
Has your house been rebuilt?
Yes, we rebuilt it, and about half of our neighbors have come back.
What street are you on?
Bluebird Street.
Bluebird Street. So you're, what, about 8 blocks from the lake?
I can walk there.
And Swine Palace is the place to be through the 17th for Rising Water, John Biganay's latest production. And you're also involved in Lafayette right now. What's going on there?
Shotgun, the second play in this trilogy, which is set 4 months after this play, opens on Saturday night. Acting Unlimited is producing a play at Theater 810 in Lafayette.
And the third installment
is Mold. It's at the summer after. It's going to open at a Southern Rep production at the Contemporary Arts Center on March 20th in conjunction with the Tennessee Williams Festival.
In New Orleans.
In New Orleans.
In New Orleans. So you've got three great Louisiana cities represented in Rising Water, which started last night.
Here at Swine Palace in Baton Rouge in the Studio Theater.
Continue through the 17th. And once again, for more information, please call 578-9277. Thank you, John Biganay. And
thank you, Jim.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.